Hello, and welcome to the traffic episode of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. Emily Peck of Axios is also here.
Hi.
We're joined by Elizabeth Spires, the editor of Gawker, amongst other things, or one of the former editors of Gawker.
Hello.
And we are joined by Ben Smith. Ben Smith, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Ben, you are joining us on an auspicious day. We have all manner of media news in the world. We obviously are going to talk about Tucker Carlson on this show. We're going to talk about BuzzFeed News, which closed down. BuzzFeed News was started by you. You are the former editor of BuzzFeed News. You have had a storied career at various different media outlets. But what are you running now? And introduce yourself.
I'm the editor-in-chief of Semaphore, a new news organization dedicated to transparent journalism and to trying to help people navigate this very complicated moment when it's very difficult to figure out who you can trust. And I'm sort of caught between the moments because I've just finished writing this book.
What is the book?
The book is called Traffic, and it's essentially the origin story of this digital age, or at least of the digital age that just came and went, the social media age.
So we're going to talk about the book and all of the little tentacles that have come out from it over the past week. It's all coming up on Slate Money.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Wow, Ben, you picked the best week to publish this book. Congratulations on being very, like, on the news cycle. What is the most relevant news article for your book right now? Is it the official death of BuzzFeed News, or is it the defenestration of Tucker Carlson?
I mean, the book really is about the end of an era. And I think we could all feel that. I mean, even when I started writing it in 2020, that the sort of moment defined by this sort of out of control social media was ending. It did feel this week like that, you know, I mean, I think BuzzFeed News, you know, for better and for worse, was really a defining news outlet of it. And I'm obviously feel really sad about it being shut down, and think we probably could have done some things differently, but also, you know, our project was to build a news organization for the social web, and I don't think we anticipated the social web kind of going away to the extent that it has. And Tucker Carlson and this wave of right-wing populism that he kind of embodied in some ways were the, you know, represented the culmination of this whole project and also the thing that made it so toxic to so many people.
Well, is it that the social web has gone away, or the, as I think you've said yourself, the marriage of news and the social web has gone away? Like, for a while, especially a place like BuzzFeed News, you thought the two fit really well together. You'd do great journalism, you'd put it out on social, it would get traffic that way. But now we're seeing sites like the New York Times, sites with homepages that people go to, legacy sites. That's where
the Huffington
is.
Post, the bit that survived, you know, gets a lot of homepage traffic. But this is the part of the book that I found most fascinating, that the people who have succeeded in marrying news and social in the 2020s is basically Tucker Carlson's site, the Daily Wire. It's the right wingers. There's a lot of that kind of, there's a lot of cameos in this book from Andrew Breitbart, Ben Shapiro, people like that. They seem to have survived where, you know, BuzzFeed News failed.
You know, I think like Emily's drawing a very good distinction, which is to say the marriage between news and the social web really clearly is at this point pretty close to over. But a big factor in that is the decline of these, of, you know, Facebook broadly as a cultural force, of Twitter broadly as a cultural force. I'm not sure how relevant Pinterest still is, but there was a period when it was very important. I mean, I think that kind of consumption and the notion that you share things everywhere you know, has been replaced in various ways by going to the New York Times app, by consuming TikTok, which isn't, for most of its users, kind of fundamentally a social platform. So I just think the culture has shifted pretty deeply. And I think, I don't think Tucker Carlson and his style of politics are really thriving and succeeding right now either. Like, clearly there, I think the style of right-wing populism that he and Trump embodied, really came to power in 2016 and used these same tools in a really unfettered way. But I don't know. I mean, I think part of the reason that people spend less time on Facebook and Twitter is because they're overtaken by this incredibly screamy, alienating style of politics.
So you would say that that period of Ben Shapiro being a force in, you know, being an electoral force, being a social force, having lots of traffic, having lots of influence, that period too is over?
So Ben Shapiro, I think it's interesting you mentioned Ben Shapiro because he got off the social web. Like they used Facebook very effectively, but he is now running a subscription video site that has users who pay him directly to go visit it. I think he is actually a survivor and is thriving. And when you think about who could plausibly afford to employ Tucker Carlson, the Daily Wire is one of the companies that could, although they're a different style of, I don't really see them as part of that movement. They're not really populists.
Well, I would say, also Ben Shapiro still gets a lot of traffic to the primary website from Facebook. In fact, you know, Kevin Roos has been doing this thing where he's charting, you know, the people who are driving some of the most traffic and shares from Facebook. And Ben is always in the top 10. So, and, you know, maybe some of that is a function of Ben's politics appealing to Facebook's audience, which now is overwhelmingly in the U.S., kind of skewing a little bit older than it did in the beginning. What do you make of that? You know, if you're saying, you know, the news and social have been decoupled, I think that's probably true for news sites that target younger users. But if you're looking at the Ben Shapiro demographic, which skews a little bit more boomer, how are they finding people like Ben Shapiro?
Everybody's traffic from Facebook is down. I mean, I haven't specifically looked at the Daily Wires, but in a way that, you know, they shifted to using Facebook the way like Disney uses Facebook as a marketing engine for its real businesses, not as its core distribution. But I agree with you that that what's left of Facebook is older, you know, and this has been true for this point, 7 years is older and more progressively older and more right wing.
One point, Ben, that you make in the book, and sort of like the tragedy of the book, I think, is, and I think I can tie this back to Tucker Carlson.
Great.
Is how the tools sort of innovated and the methods innovated by Jonah Peretti, the founder of BuzzFeed, you know, making very social, shareable content, stuff that people have to share and show each other. Those tools were sort of co-opted by the right and the Daily Wire. And they were like, knew no boundaries when it came to like creating things that people had to share or, you know, click on or whatever. Because there weren't the journalistic standards there that you have in news. You know, not every news story is going to be shareable, but you can
Breitbart
make...
The Daily Wire is sort of an outlier.
Okay, so Breitbart
feels to me like the core example of this.
Yeah, totally. So Breitbart. And the way I think about it and tie it to Fox News or someone like Tucker Carlson is like, if you don't care about journalism or ethics or standards and you know how attention works and you know what people like, which is often... almost always not what you think is important or news, like you're going to get the attention, you're going to get the traffic. It's like you get the fire hose. It's all you. Like that's what Tucker Carlson was doing.
Well, yeah. And you can be famously just a pair of teenagers in Macedonia. You don't even need to be Tucker Carlson.
Yeah.
You can be anyone with no real ethics. But Ben, you mentioned Breitbart, who is a really fascinating character in your book. Who was, explain a little bit about the relationship between Andrew Breitbart and Arianna Huffington, because this one is perennially fascinating to me.
Yeah, and this, I would say, like, this is one of these things where you really had to be there. Fortunately, we were all there. But to think that if you're going to start a left-wing website, it makes sense to hire someone from a right-wing website. Like, why would you do that? And the answer is because, like, we're all websites, like blogs. Like, this is this tiny little world of blogs, and you have more in common with the other bloggers than you do with those, you know, people out in the non-digital world. And so Ariana is looking to start a left-wing rival to the Drudge Report, basically. And so naturally tries to pick off Matt Drudge's deputy, who, by the way, also used to work for her in her recently passed conservative life in California. And those lines, I mean, society is so politically divided now. And it was a less politically polarized society and moment, and so it just seemed slightly less insane that you would go and pick up and hire from the explicitly opposite ideological side in order to fight them. I mean, still quite insane, and did not work out.
Yeah, I mean, I think of Ariana kind of as a little bit centrist, though, and I think there is a conventional wisdom in centrist, particularly political media, that if you skew toward the middle, you're going to get a bigger audience because you'll get some conservatives and some liberals. And I think that's kind of not really correct logic, but I think that was part of the thinking, you know?
Well, I mean, but Huffington Post, I mean, they'd had a meeting after, you know, after Kerry lost in 2004 and said, we want to build a website to beat Bush, to beat the Republicans and help the Democrats win. So, I mean, I don't know ideologically. I mean, it was definitely a partisan project. And then it became really a Barack Obama project in the primary, which, again, I don't think was necessarily because they were, as you say, like less or more centrist. But it was definitely it was of the kind of cultural left in that way when that was who Obama was.
The George Clooney left.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. But tell me, like, who deserves the credit for it? Because eventually, you know, BuzzFeed and Huffington Post ended up merging, and they had two newsrooms in one small and struggling company, and that never felt particularly sustainable. And eventually the newsroom that ended up getting killed off was BuzzFeed News rather than HuffPost. And the reason, as I think we've suggested, I think, tell me if you would disagree with that, with this, but the reason I would say is precisely what Emily said, is that HuffPost has homepage traffic and has a brand, and people kind of know what it stands for, in the way that BuzzFeed News was more reliant on social. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, it's more broadly, we're in this totally bizarre moment where the social web, and particularly Facebook, has just receded for news publishers to such a degree. And kind of what's left is the internet of 2007 is, you know, people who are 15 years older but are still going to drudgereport.com and huffingtonpost.com to see what's happening on these homepages that never really did go away. Yahoo remains a place people go for news.
Would it be fair, just to like end that thought, would it be fair to suggest that the architect of that Huffington Post homepage and the idea, the reason why people come back, even though he was at the other end of the political spectrum and failed out very quickly, was actually Andrew Breitbart. And that if Huffington Post has that longevity, it really is because, you know, if you're looking to the co-founders, it's because of Andrew Breitbart more than it is because of Jonah Peretti.
Yeah.
No, I don't think, I actually think Breitbart did not wind up really designing much or contributing much. I mean, they kind of cloned the look of the Drudge Report's webpage, but he was not, as they say, a cultural fit and didn't stick around, I don't think, even to the time they launched.
But I don't think, the culture at HuffPost is very much centered on that homepage. Worked there, it's all about who's getting the splash. That's like the big story at the top. And they're always trying to be like really creative with the splash. And there's a big team on the homepage. And one thing that was different between HuffPost and BuzzFeed, and maybe this is a little too in the weeds, is that BuzzFeed made the decision to kind of like silo the news from the rest of the site, whereas HuffPost, there are reporters and editors doing like journalism and news, but there's also like a huge lifestyle team doing the stuff that gets like the traffic and the advertisers and doing affiliate links and all that stuff. And it's all kind of it's all together on the homepage. There's no real distinction. Like, this is HuffPost News. This is HuffPost whatever, beauty. You know, yeah, it's all one like thing.
There was, to Emily's point, there was some brand confusion. You know, sometimes, you know, HuffPost News did some amazing investigative work. But I would see, you know, people who don't work in media don't really make the distinction would be like, oh, yeah, that's the site where they give us, like, lifestyle quizzes.
Right.
And it was confusing to them because it's kind of like under the same umbrella. But I don't think readers really understood the distinction necessarily.
Right. But it seemed like there was more of a deliberate walling off or something at BuzzFeed News. I don't know if that's true.
Yeah. And maybe, you know, initially it was a reaction to the moment, I think. I mean, and I maybe a mistake. The, you know, when we launched, we very deliberately kind of blurred the lines. And it was a moment when Facebook, when this is a hard experience to remember, but people liked the idea that they had these new Facebook news feeds where baby pictures and news and silly memes were all mixed up together and all your, you know, all in one place. How fun. And as that grew really toxic and the sort of cultural perception of that new of the news feed changed, and the notion that, like, wow, news is this fun thing that can be mixed up with other things started to seem insane. We tried to kind of pull the news brand away from the entertainment brand. I mean, there's also this issue around, like, you know, you can either try to sell advertising against news by kind of disguising it as something that isn't news and selling it against the lifestyle stuff, or you can try to build a distinct news business by saying, well, we're reaching this influential audience that's a somewhat different an audience that you should pay more for. And I think the BuzzFeed sort of was attempting and didn't make it to sell that second place,
which is the Axios business, right? You try and sell an influence.
It's the New York Times business.
Or the Semaphore business, ostensibly.
It's a Semaphore business. I think news publishers.
The difference between Axios and Semaphore on the one hand and the New York Times on the other is that the New York Times gets most of its money from subscription revenues. Like, Axios is still out there, you know, playing on some level the traffic game, but it's at much higher CPMs and it's at a much more sort of targeted, high, you know, elite audience. So we can sort of maybe, hopefully, fingers crossed, survive in the way that, you know, we're not playing the sheer traffic game that, like, is the subject of your book, and that Jonah Peretti and Nick Denton, who are the main subjects of your book, really were just like, more eyeballs is more money. I need to maximize the number of humans who are reading my site, and that way I am going to make the most money. Which I guess worked.
And doing journalism is just never going to be the most efficient way to produce content for eyeballs. Like, it is, as Emily said, like, way cheaper to just not check the facts and make it up, or to make delightful roundups of memes.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, those are both just less expensive ways to get traffic. And if what you're trying to do is just sell traffic, which is, you know, that's, you know, there's, you don't really have a choice but to do it very inexpensively, because the other thread running through the last 15 years is that, you know, I think the people early on who had discovered traffic felt like it was this digital commodity, like it was oil. They'd struck oil. The more you got, the more money you'd make. But the thing is, you know, as, you know, Felix will no doubt at some point correct my, or all, and Emily, like, my attempt to, all of you will correct my attempts to use the word commodity. But I think scarcity is a really important part of that. And, you know, as it turned out, traffic was, you know, there's almost an infinite amount of it. Its value diminished. Yeah. And that's the other sort of thread running through this.
I think that's true, but I will, in defense of the Gawker that I was no longer working at, they had a chief revenue officer named James Dell, who I think did really innovative things for their revenue model. You know, they ended up having a big commerce business. They were one of the first digital publications to start doing native advertising and to function as an agency on the back end of it. And they were profitable when Peter Thiel sued them out of existence.
Yeah. I mean, BuzzFeed was profitable in that same period with those same models. And
BuzzFeed was very purist in many ways. I remember, you know, the era of BuzzFeed when Jonah was adamant that there would be no banner ads. You know, everything would be native.
Yeah.
And then, in a way, like, the fact that he hired you and spun up a news business, it was sign of a kind of romantic strain of how he was thinking, right? Like, was there a business reason to do news in the first place? What was his reason for doing that?
So I think the business logic initially was very clear and bore out, which was that it was really important for the brand to move out of being seen as one of a number of kind of bottom of the internet meme sites. Like, if you remember
Cheeseburger,
Break.com. I mean, 9gag was the biggest. And those were sites that by, you know, 2015, 2016, 2017 didn't exist anymore. Partly because the social networks decided that they did not even have enough redeeming social value for Facebook and killed them. And so I think in some sense, from a brand perspective, that means brand to readers, it means brand to advertisers, it was really important. It kind of vaulted BuzzFeed into this totally different category of being culturally relevant. You know, and the sort of most immediate kind of consequence of that is that the platforms can treat you like a first-class citizen as they did publishers, or they can treat you as spam. And very important for any publisher that you're in that first category, even as that also diminished quite a bit in value.
You cover this in the book, but I think you should explain to listeners why you moved out of traditional media and went to BuzzFeed.
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't been in exactly traditional media for a while. I had been a political reporter who basically saw what Elizabeth was doing at Gawker and started copying it in politics. Using the tools of blogging just to do straight reporting, but to do it incrementally, to do it fast, to do it on the internet. And then was at Politico when it started, and we were the new thing, and essentially professionalized these blogging tools. Sites like Politico and The Verge, I would say, did that in around like 2007. As did Gawker, in a less sort of, not in any particular, but that was sort of the direction of travel, was toward turning these tools toward professional journalism. But if you were working at one of those sites in 2009, 2010, 2011, you could just feel the energy being sucked out of them by social media. And if you were watching your traffic, as I always was at Politico, you could just see that people stopped coming to the blog and were over on Twitter, and that the fun thing, if you got a scoop, the cool thing to do was to watch it travel on Twitter. And so when Jonah kind of approached me with the idea of like, there's this new world where people are going to open up their desktop computers and type in facebook.com or twitter.com. And that's the challenge for content is going to be distributed on those platforms. An era which is now over, but was then new. It just totally made intuitive sense to me. And that's kind of why I came to join him.
Can we just talk for a second about, because you mentioned Jonah's overall plan and creating BuzzFeed News, which you could argue now looks like a mistake, but at the time made sense, as Ben has just laid it out. What about the decision to not do a deal with Disney? Disney was offering so much money. I mean, that could have been the lifeline. Like, HuffPost survived probably because it got bought by AOL, and then it got bought by Verizon, and it got those injections. I don't know.
Ben would have four vacation houses right now.
Probably, yeah.
It wasn't a good financial decision. I'm right.
Those RSUs would have stacked.
In the question of shareholder value, it was obviously just the stupidest imaginable decision.
Did Jonah know that at the time, though? I feel like at the time, people were like, this was like Mark Zuckerberg turning down $1 billion from Facebook.
Right.
Yahoo.
Everybody
whatever,
was living in the shadow of that story. Yes. Mark Zuckerberg turning down the first offer. Not like the sort of much more common story of Mark Cuban becoming a zillionaire for selling some company everybody that never really had an audience that everyone is, no one can remember what it was, which is how most of these Silicon Valley guys are rich. It's right, but it's such a snapshot of the time. One is that we kind of thought we were ascendant, right? And that we were just getting started, and I'd been there for less than 2 years when those conversations were happening. And it felt like the wind was at our back. Mm-hmm. Everything was growing. But I think more selfishly for Jonah and for me and for a lot of our colleagues, not the president of the company, John Steinberg, and not our investors, we felt like we were building this thing and doing work that was really exciting. And the prospect of essentially being plugged into Disney and to ABC News to help them figure out their websites just wasn't what we'd signed up for. And if we'd wanted to be sort of like employees of large corporations who were well compensated for helping them modernize, we would have chosen totally different career paths and have been different people. And so, like, I wasn't, I mean, none of us probably got into this to, you know, to in a totally financially motivated way. It's the wrong profession for it. And so I think we made kind of non-financial and retrospectively just moronic decisions.
So wind it forwards. Like, if you'd done it, if you'd said yes, like, the stated reason for not doing it was, like, Disney would have suffocated us. I mean, they would have done, right?
Yeah, they would have. I mean, you know, the other, the, in fact, there's, you don't have to sort of guess. They took that money and acquired Maker Studios, and which was the sort of a YouTube middleman, basically, that was going to be their path to the internet, and it collapsed and no longer exists.
I believe there was also a company they sunk a bunch of money into called Fusion, which I used to work for. And and I can tell you, as someone who worked at Fusion, and this has been reported, you know, they did interfere and they did want to stick their oar in, you know, and there was a constant fight to stop, you know, being told what to do by people who presumably, like, you know, you exist because they don't know what's best, but they can never resist meddling.
Yeah. And I guess the other example is Disney buying Nate Silver's 538 or buying
The other media news, 538 is dying as well.
Yeah. So, yeah, this week Nate Silver said they weren't going to renew his contract and everyone got laid off. And I guess Nate Silver is the one who has the rights to whatever models they use to do their big branded things around elections and sports. So, like, when he leaves, that leaves with him. So, effectively, not really a thing anymore, 538. So, I guess, Ben, what you're saying is either, or what Felix is kind of saying is either way, if you had done the Disney deal or not done the Disney deal, probably in the end, BuzzFeed would probably not exist in 2023 either way.
Yeah, I mean, or BuzzFeed News. It's hard to predict. It's hard to predict, and we did an enormous amount of pretty ambitious independent journalism that I'm proud of doing. So I guess I don't have really regrets about it.
Ostensibly, there would still be a BuzzFeed, but it would be, which Disney princess are you, you know?
Well, that never went away. they have that anyway.
I mean, people need to know.
Yeah, or maybe it would be a television show. You know, or maybe they would have successfully migrated the brand into streaming in a way that, you know, who knows? It's hard to know.
We are going to have an ad-supported ad break from advertisers paying very high CPMs to podcasts because to podcasts are the new blogs or something like that. We will be back talking about Tucker Carlson being out at Fox News. This episode of Slate Money is brought to you by Wondery, which is a podcast company, and it makes a podcast called The Best One Yet, and it is a daily podcast hosted by Nick and Jack, who serve up three of the most interesting business news stories every day and why you need to know them in just 20 minutes. Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that saved Abercrombie, or which real tech acquisitions like Game of Thrones, or the one financial equation that can finally solve climate change? That's the kind of stuff you find on The Best One Yet. So be in the know this year by starting your morning with The Best One Yet every weekday. Follow The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more. Wondery means business.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
Chumba. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Should we talk about the Fox News?
Yes. What's the Fox News?
Well, that's the big news of the week. I thought it was going to be our top thing. The Fox News is, there's lots of it, actually. They were headed in. We didn't talk about the Dominion trial yet, did we?
Yeah, we did. We talked about that.
Oh, we did. Okay, so we don't have to talk about that. The other Fox News is that out of nowhere, it seemed to us, they fired Tucker Carlson, who was the host of their biggest show, their 8 p.m. slot. They told him, they announced they were parting ways. They said his last show was last week. He didn't have the opportunity to say goodbye to anyone. And we're actually taping this. I will reveal to you that we're taping this on Wednesday. So it's been 3 days of a frenzy of news articles in which people said, this is the reason Tucker Carlson was fired. And there are many reasons that have been listed. The Dominion suit, there, you know, because of the stuff Tucker Carlson said that was out there from the deposition. Or some are saying it's this Abby Grossberg suit. She was a producer on a show who filed a sexual harassment, hostile workplace lawsuit. And there's all kinds of details about how terrible it is to work on the Tucker Carlson show. Like,
well, we're going to come to that. But let me just talk about the Dominion thing, because that one's really interesting. Apparently, Tucker's upset that, like, for, you know, he may or may not have been singled out for being fired in the context of a whole bunch of people like Maria Bartiromo and others who were just as conspiracy-minded in terms of what they put on the air. The big difference and the reason why Tucker Carlson was much worse for that suit than someone like Maria Bartiromo is not just that he was on at 8 p.m. It's because in order to win that suit, Dominion needed to show that they knew they were lying. It was malicious what they were doing to Dominion. And Maria Bartiromo, there's nothing on the record from her saying, this is all complete bullshit and I know that I'm lying. Whereas with Tucker, he's smart enough and or dumb enough to have put it in writing that, like, he said that all of these people he was having on the show were complete lunatics and were off their tree. And yet he went on and put them on the air anyway. And that is what, that's how you get to $787 million in damages. If you believe your lies, then that's not, then that's a defense.
I mean, Carlson had Sidney Powell on the air and took her apart and used disgusting language to describe her in private emails. And actually, I mean, there are many very fun explanations for why Fox fired Tucker Carlson, none of which really make any sense.
No, but the best explanation of all, or at least the one that Emily and I love the most, is this was all done as a way of Rupert Murdoch getting back at his ex-fiancée. Remember, he was like engaged for 2 weeks to Leslie Ann Smith, and she literally thought that Tucker Carlson was sent by God as a prophet. And so the minute he breaks up with Leslie Ann Smith, Rupert Murdoch does not do like amicable splits. So he just goes all out. And so he fires Leslie Ann's favorite host as part of the divorce, which they were never even married.
I mean, but the problem is he had broken up with her sometime before, a couple weeks before. He had said misogynistic things for a very long time. He had been insubordinate for a very long time. Somebody woke up Sunday morning and decided to fire him. And part of the problem is that there's a number of sort of official sounding leaks out of Fox about how there were meetings and how they had thoughtful conversations and they care about this or they care about that. And they just lie so much. I mean, you think they lie on the air, like their communications department just is the least reliable element of American media. And so you've got to assume that most of the anonymous sources are lying when you read stories about Fox.
There was a story that Irina Brigante, who's the very powerful, you know, head of PR at Fox, has a dossier on Carlson that if he, you know, says anything negative about the network or goes to a competitor or does anything antagonistic, they're just going to release. Does that sound plausible to you? Do you think that there's something
that's obvious nonsense
about Carlson that's going to be worse?
I mean, sure, whatever. But they just go around making inane threats against each other all the time. That just seems like obvious nonsense. There was a lawsuit. There was discovery. I mean, of course they have a dossier of stupid things they've all said to each other, but that just struck me as like the most sort of obvious theatrical BS that the Fox people put out to make themselves look like they have power, like these executives, Suzanne Scott, Irina Briganti, who are, you know, totally helpless while the inmates run the asylum. And then occasionally Rupert wanders in and makes autocratic decisions, and then he wanders out again. And then they try to explain it like it's a normal company.
Interesting. I like that. What about, there was a journal story earlier this week that basically was like, actually, Tucker Carlson maybe got the ratings, but he didn't have any of the top tier advertisers. No one wanted to be associated with that show except the MyPillow guy, basically, and a few other people. And I guess his ratings were even slipping, and they said some show called The Five, which I think I only am aware of because I watch Saturday Night Live sometimes, was actually beating it. So he perhaps wasn't as big of a ratings draw as he is thought to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a slow news cycle. And so sort of softer show, I mean, this week, really. And so for the last several months, softer shows have been outperforming hard news sort of across, you know, I mean, it makes sense. We've been all watching Succession rather than CNN. You know what I mean?
it's much more entertaining.
There are all these true facts that are reasons that Tucker Carlson, as an employee of any of our companies, you know, would have been fired. It's just that the notion that, but also they fired him on 10 minutes notice on a Monday morning. I mean, it's just not, I mean, they're trying to repackage this as some normal corporate decision in what is obviously a totally bizarre family business that operates, that does not operate in a
normal
way.
That's the best take of all.
It's
Rupert being Logan Roy and capricious.
He broke off his engagement. He got engaged 2 weeks ago, broke off the engagement.
In an email.
He announced that his two public companies were merging several months ago, decided, actually, never mind. I mean, under some pressure. It just seems like you have a 92-year-old making some decisions at a rapid pace.
Ben, when are you going to publish this take? Because it's the best one yet.
We published it. Max Tani wrote it. It's the truth. Yeah.
Let me ask you about the power of Fox to create Tucker Carlson's. Like we have a long history of these kind of people. There was Glenn Beck. There was Bill O'Reilly. There was even like Megyn Kelly for a hot second. There was Tucker Carlson. Every time, you know, each of these people feels very big. Jack Schaefer has a good column about this. And then they go, and then there's someone new, and it's just the caravan moves on. Do we expect that Murdoch and Suzanne Scott and the people in charge of Fox News still have the power to install someone in that 8 p.m. slot and like make them the, you know, this huge ratings hogging star? Or is that those days waning too?
Of course they do. I mean, their audience is the oldest of the old cable news audiences, and it's folks who, you know, find their content by speaking aloud to their remote. They're not people who are going to download an app and follow you to your new platform. It's just not that generation of users. And I think the clearest evidence of that is that they launched a streaming service called Fox Nation that totally bombed, despite it being called Fox Nation and marketed incessantly on Fox.
Yeah, they're just going to wheel in some other person. It doesn't really matter because it's all, they have the built-in audience at Fox News. People will tune in. Doesn't really matter who's in the chair. And it's not like we'll miss Tucker Carlson's distinctive journalism where he had stories no one else had, right? I mean, they'll find some other personality who'll say some other kind of off-the-wall things to appeal to the same audience.
Yeah, they'll find somebody who that audience likes. I suspect, though, usually they're broadcasters or Republican Party apparatchiks who are, you know, entertaining and colorful and say things that, you know, lots of people object to, but are not like funded, but also care a lot about winning elections for Republicans and care a lot about the Murdoch company bottom line. I don't think Tucker really cared about winning elections for Republicans. Like, he was leading an insurgency out of the Republican mm-hmm. Party. He was inviting Viktor Orban onto the show. He was like,
didn't he go to Hungary and do like week from Budapest?
Yes.
Yeah.
He was sort of driving a message, like a very explicit racist message that, you know, I think, I guess, I mean, there's obviously a dispute, like, is Trump just the embodiment of the Republican Party or is he an outlier? Like, Tucker was the Trump of Fox and will be replaced by the DeSantis of Fox, like somebody who looks and who says some of the same words but basically just wants to cut taxes.
He famously gave a talk at a dinner for Orban where he said, you know, I love you guys because you hate all the right people. And everyone instantly knew what he meant.
Yeah, but that was also the Gorka crew. You know, they all bonded over who they hated as well. And as long as you hated the right people, you would fit right in at Gorka.
It depended on the Gawker editor, but, you know.
But we should... Elizabeth Spires predates the era of Gorka editors having large staff who needed to get on. It was just a one-woman show at that point. We need one more ad break because we are ad-supported, except for you lovely Slate Plus folks. We love you very much. You give us our beautiful subscription revenue, which helps diversify our revenue. After these ads, we're going to have the numbers round. Let's have a numbers round. Emily, did you bring a number?
I did. I brought a number. My number is 69. Haha. $1 billion. That was or is the Microsoft bid for Activision, but this week that bid, which was already kind of under fire in the U.S. by the FTC, we learned this week that British regulators blocked the bid. And now it's looking kind of sketch if it goes through or not. And this is a big deal, literally a big deal. One of the, I think, the biggest tech deal since like AOL Time Warner. So that didn't end well either. So we'll
see
how this goes.
The Brits, first they scupper Barclays buying Lehman Brothers, and then they scupper Microsoft buying Activision. All of these things, you can just blame the Brits.
Well, Microsoft's going to fight it, so it's not over.
Yeah.
Yet.
We'll see.
My number is 14, and that's the number of years Gawker was in business before Peter Thiel put it out of business, which I just want to point out is 4 years longer than Peter Thiel's hedge fund Clarium Capital is in business after it famously imploded and Gawker wrote about it. So
noted.
Yeah, we there is a pretty compelling story that the thing that Peter Thiel hated about Gorka was the reporting on Clarium much more than the reporting on him being gay, which is why everyone thinks that he was annoyed at Gorka.
Yes, that's my theory too.
My number, since we're being a bit newsy, is $19 billion. This is yet another mini bank crisis week. The bank in crisis this week is First Republic. And one of the interesting things about First Republic was people thought that it wasn't a Silicon Valley bank in terms of the assets on its balance sheet. It didn't have a whole bunch of bonds that were underwater. Turns out it had a bunch of mortgages that were underwater. They were lending interest-only mortgages to people, and they were like lending money to the president of Goldman Sachs. The president of Goldman Sachs is probably borrowing money from you because you're giving him a really good deal. And the mortgage portfolio was $19 billion lower than its book value. And they only had core regulatory capital of $14 billion. So they basically, the First Republic problem is exactly the same as the Silicon Valley Bank problem, which is that their capital can't keep up with the mark-to-market losses on their fixed income portfolio. It's just their fixed income portfolio, instead of being agency MBS, is actual mortgages to human beings. I suspect that next week on Slate Money, we'll be talking more about First Republic Bank. Ben Smith, what's your number?
Yeah, so I brought a number from the distant past, and so, you know, in the media business, which is that one of the things that struck me in reporting out this book is the CPMs Gawker, CPM meaning cost for 1,000 views, which is the sort of standard price sheet of for digital media, in 2003 when Gawker started selling advertising was $9, and if you're sort of familiar with the business, that's like today, like a little on the high end. But if you're getting that on a sort of standard issue website, that's like pretty good. But if you're trying to sell scale, if you're BuzzFeed or something like that. And what's sort of amazing, I mean, it just shows you like, you know, it's essentially declined in value. It's a something that has declined in value since they started telling it in 2003.
But in 2003, you know, when Elizabeth was running Gorkha in 2003, it was deliberately being marketed as a website for the Manhattan elite. Like, you had that elite audience at the time. Or you
yeah, also, there was... I want to point out, because this is early Gawker, you know, craziness, there was no real ad-serving platform in late 2002, early 2003. And nobody was buying ads on blogs because there were no commercial blogs. And so Nick put up like a fake Corcoran banner that just linked to the Corcoran website. It wasn't a real ad, but the idea was that it would signal that space was available. And sure enough, yeah. Somebody from Douglas Elliman called like a couple of months in and was like, how much for that spot?
but just to think of, it's incredible, but also just to think that they invented this very, very rudimentary business, and you would have in any normal world thought, wow, like as we get better at this and more sophisticated and the market grows, like these numbers are going to go up. And instead they went down.
Yeah, we really need to get John Battelle on the show, because he's the guy who really understands the economics of banner ads better than anyone in the world. And he is very guilty about it. He's like, I should never have invented that ad server. It was the worst thing I ever did for the ecology of the internet. But what your number reminds me of, Ben, is the famous thing that, like, you know, back in the 1930s, the New Yorker was paying its writer like $1 a word. And you know, that dollar a word freelance rate has basically stood still for 90 years. Like, these things don't go up.
Tough business.
Tough business. Thanks for joining us, Ben. It's been amazing having you on this show.
It's really so fun to talk to you all, you know, fellow veterans of that era about it.
We're all ex-bloggers. I don't know how many... you know, podcasts there are these days where everyone is an ex-blogger.
Emily's like, I'm not a blogger.
I'm a proper journalist.
Do not self-identify as a blogger, Emily.
Emily used to work for the Wall Street Journal. She never blogged.
I mean, I technically blogged at the Wall Street Journal, but I don't think that counts.
Thanks to Patrick for producing. Thanks to all of you for writing in. Let us know what you want to know about First Republic next week on SlateMoney@Slate.com. And we'll be back on Monday with the next episode of Slate Money Succession.